This is Impact Radio from the campus of Michigan State University. Here's more MSU Today with Russ White.
In 1973, the year he turned 18, John Sita graduated from Michigan's child welfare system to a life of homelessness and shoplifting on the streets of East Lansing. Jobless, depressed, and lacking any family or professional support, Sita had reached one of the two lowest points of his young life. The other, being removed from his abusive home at age 8 and placed in the first of many foster homes and institutions in Ohio and Michigan. But Sita, now an associate professor of social work at Michigan State University, considers himself lucky. Many other children raised in foster care or group homes age out of the state-supported system at 18, only to end up on drugs, in prison or prostitution, or dead at an early age, he says.
Well, as a child and an adolescent, I spent many years in the foster care system, both in Ohio and in Michigan, most of my time being in Michigan. And I went into foster care as a result of parental neglect and abuse. My mother was a single parent, didn't have parenting skills, had problems with drugs and alcohol, couldn't maintain relationships, and did not take care of her children. And so, as a consequence, we became wards of the state of Ohio. And I lived in many foster homes in Ohio before I was transferred to Michigan as a 12-year-old, and then ended up living in a residential care facility in Michigan for 6 years or so. So that kind of is the history of my journey into foster care and prior to foster care.
Talk a little bit more about your feelings of being like taken from the home. What does that feel like at that age?
Well, for me, that was a horrible experience. It was one of, regardless of what my mother did or did not do, I loved her very dearly and very deeply, and most children do. And so when I was taken from my mother's apartment, I was angry and scared, uncertain, afraid, and really it was in a sense of denial. It was almost a surreal experience, and one I didn't believe and didn't want to believe. And for many years after having been in foster care, I often fantasized that it was a bad dream, and that I was going to wake up the next morning and I would be at home with my mother and my stepfather, and that we'd be one happy family. But that didn't happen, and I knew it wasn't going to happen, but I kept hoping that would happen. So it's just an experience that I wish no one had to go through, because being ripped away from your parents and your mother is it's brutal, and the impact lasts for many, many years beyond the experience itself.
And elaborate then on your experiences in foster care and some of the feelings that go with those experiences.
Well, when I was in foster care, I think the first most potent feeling that I had was this wasn't my real home, and I wasn't going to pretend it was my real home, and I wasn't going to let these foster parents pretend that they were my parents. And so one of my first feelings and my first behaviors was to literally and figuratively rebel against any foster parent that tried to parent me. And so I would act out, I would disobey rules, I would not do my schoolwork. I would fight with other kids. I would fight with them. I would scream, yell. I would tear things up. I would throw my possessions away or destroy my possessions. So I would do anything I could do to sabotage a foster home placement, because I wanted to be with my mother and my brother and sister. And so as a consequence, I had 15 placements in a very short time while in Ohio, because they simply couldn't find a place that was equipped to deal with a kid like me who had such attachment issues and such relationship problems and such a strong desire to live with my own family.
Did that, settle down at all before you were 18, or is that when you're freed from the system, or did you just fight it right to the end?
Well, it settled down to a degree. I went to a boys' home in Michigan, in Albion, Star Commonwealth, and it settled down quite a bit there for a couple of reasons. One reason it settled down was that it wasn't a foster home in the classic sense. It was more of an institution. And as a consequence, I wasn't expected to bond or to accept anybody as my parent. They were house parents there, but it wasn't the same expectations, the same dynamic. There were 12 or 13 kids in each home, and so there wasn't the intimacy that you'd have in a typical family. So it settled down for a while there. The irony is, though, is that sometimes maladaptive behavior is actually adaptive in the short run. So what young people do and what I did when you're in a situation like that is you keep yourself safe from emotional harm, you keep yourself safe from rejection by avoiding relationships and by avoiding intimacy. And what happened in my case is that strategy was very effective because I didn't have any close or intimate relationships growing up while in the foster care system. On the other hand, when I left foster care, that same strategy was ineffective because it didn't allow me to connect with people I needed to connect with as a young adult. So any dating relationships were disastrous. Work relationships were often troublesome. And personal friendships were difficult to have because I simply didn't trust people.
And John, how would you characterize the foster care system today? I mean, does it work? What works? What doesn't work? And part of the reason for asking that, you know, the stereotype is that a lot of the foster parents, because these are the ones that make news, I guess, are like evil and they've got evil intentions with the kids. Are most foster parents good people that are trying, as part of the question? And then in general, how is it all working?
Well, it's a multifaceted question. It's difficult to answer, but I'll do my best. I think most foster parents are good people. I think they're well-intended. I think they have big hearts, and I think they want to be a positive force in young people's lives who have been abused and neglected. The big challenge, I think, comes on several levels. One level is that I don't think we equip our foster parents very well to be effective foster parents. It's difficult enough in America today being a parent. And those of us who are parents face those challenges. Imagine, if you will, being a foster parent. You're dealing with a young person who has many of the characteristics that I had. They're angry, they're bitter, they're maladjusted, they don't want to adapt, they don't want to be part of a family. They're using every survival strategy they can, and often those are fighting strategies. And so then we put these young people into a foster home under tight budget circumstances for our state and our federal government, and we don't necessarily train our foster parents very effectively to deal with young people who are so angry, who are so bitter, who are so hard to reach. And so the foster care system is handicapped right off the bat from that perspective. Secondly, and this isn't a perspective I've heard very often, is there is a lot of blame, a lot of discussion, a lot of criticism of the foster care system, and I'm sure some of it is warranted. On the other hand, we're dealing with young people that do come in the conditions I've described, and since we don't equip the parents, we are expecting them to work miracles with emotionally damaged and fragile young people. And frankly, given the conditions that these foster parents are working with, sometimes I think many of them are miracle workers. On the other hand, we do need to provide more capacity building. So the system is failing, but in many ways it's failing because there are so many challenging conditions that would cause it to fail that I've already noted, the kind of young people that are coming in, the challenges that they bring, the lack of capacity. It's kind of like democracy. It's probably not a very good system, but it's the best one we have right now.
And how much impact or possible impact do foster care alumni like you have in shaping the system as it moves forward?
Well, I think our historical role in shaping the system has been nearly non-existent. And in both my literature review and my own direct research, I have found a real lack of input by foster care alumni into shaping the system. When I did literature reviews to find out if there were any historical figures who had a role in shaping foster care, I had to go back to about 1910 when Teddy Roosevelt had found an alumnus that he had befriended and had him on a commission. Beyond that, I didn't find a lot of historical figures. I then did my own research here at Michigan State University and surveyed 103 agencies in the state of Michigan who serve young people in foster care, and found out that none of them had a president or an executive director or even an executive of any type who had been in the foster care system. And so as an alumnus of the system, I found that troubling, disconcerting, and in many ways kind of antithetical to the kind of principles that social workers and other caring professionals would have toward empowerment and inclusion. So there hasn't been much of a role. There are some agencies now that are starting to think that's important. But even that, in my judgment as an alumnus, has its shortcomings because it strikes me that some of the roles that alumni are being given are still more support roles and under the direction of those who have not been in foster care, so I'm a little troubled by the movement. On the other hand, any movement is good movement. Certainly, my interest is in creating pathways for young people and even middle-aged people who had been in foster care to start to have influence on shaping foster care policies, foster care practices, and how resources are spent and invested. So I think there's a big role, but today it's been a pretty minimal role.
Is this a national problem, and or does Michigan have its own unique challenges?
Well, it's a national problem. I mean, I think Michigan has its unique challenges only to the degree that the state is having a pretty damaging economic cycle right now. And so because our economy is pretty poor compared to many states and perhaps the rest of the country, we have fewer resources. We have folks leaving Michigan. Perhaps there's a bit of a brain drain. But the and what we also know about cycles of abuse and neglect is that when micro or macro economies are poor, there is more abuse, there is more neglect, there is more spousal abuse, there's more divorce, because on top of the challenges of being a husband or a father or a wife or a mother, when people don't have jobs, when they don't feel that their basic needs are being met, they end up taking their frustrations out on people close to them. So I suppose in some respects Michigan probably has more challenges than many other states, but the notion that foster care is a Michigan problem would probably not be accurate, because all over the country we have, you know, we have 600,000 young people in out-of-home settings right now, and I imagine it's an undercount. So it's not unique to Michigan, but we have our unique problems.
I'm guessing it's huge, but how big of a problem is the lack of resources?
You know, that had to be kind of a guesstimate on my part or an opinion, but, you know, any time you have a disadvantaged population that has special needs and there's competition for resources among, you know, various constituencies, we're going to have problems with meeting the needs of young people and the people that serve young people. How big of a problem it is, I'm not sure. I think those are kind of trailing indicators where we find out 3 to 4 years down the road how big a problem it really is. So we can only guesstimate at this point.
Who are the key advocates for improving the foster care system, and who's standing in the way?
Well, that's a great question. I think the key advocates are, you know, some of the people that you're talking to, folks like Angelique and myself. Certainly, my director here at Michigan State, Gary Anderson, is nationally recognized for his research and his advocacy on behalf of foster care and foster care alumni. Nationally, people like the Casey Foundation are taking a lead in getting alumni more involved. So there are pockets of success and pockets of hope. In terms of getting in the way, what I will say to you in the most general of terms, existing systems and bureaucracies are getting in the way. And it's like that in every industry, but we are reluctant to embrace change unless we're forced to. And so you have folks that say to themselves, well, this is how we've always done it. And everybody would deny that. But the outcomes and the practice is clear, is that we're always doing what we've always done, and we're expecting different outcomes. And of course, that's a definition of insanity, perhaps. So I think existing systems are probably the biggest barrier at this point. I think another barrier, frankly, is a lack of insight and sensitivity. As a man, I have no idea what it's like to be a woman in this country. I have no idea the challenges that face women. As a majority person, I have no idea what it's like to be a minority in America. I can partner with people different than me to build stronger solutions, but for me to assume that I can individually craft solutions would be inappropriate. So sometimes, going back to this notion of alumni involvement, I believe if we had more alumni involved in the system, that their insight, their unique experiences would shape policy and practice. And I think one of the bigger barriers, to go back to your question, is there simply is kind of a lack of understanding of what it's like to be shifted from home to home to home, what it's like to be torn away from your parents, what it's like to scratch, claw, beg to survive. And I think all those are experiences that are badly needed in system reform.
When and why did you, John, decide to become a child welfare professional?
Well, you know, that's a great question, too, because when I was going to college at Western Michigan, I had decided I was going to stay away from child welfare and foster care because I'd had enough of it. I mean, this is like, you know, I did not want to relive that. And when I was working on my dissertation at Western, I started doing some research on foster care alumni, and I realized that they were having a really tough lot in life, and that I was really lucky and fortunate to have survived the gauntlet of foster care, to have gone through, you know, transition to young adulthood relatively unscathed. And it was at that point that I felt like I had this kind of a calling, and it sounds spiritual, and perhaps it is, a calling to make a contribution, to see if I could make a difference, and to try and benefit others through this unique niche I found myself in. So I was, you know, in my early 30s, and all of a sudden it hit me that I could make a difference. And so I set aside my fears, I set aside my embarrassment, and decided to get back involved in this field and try and make a contribution.
Tell me about some of the successes you've had in changing the system.
Well, we've done a number of things. I was invited by former Governor John Engler to be involved in the Children's Commission. And the Children's Commission was a statewide body appointed by the governor to explore child welfare policies, child welfare practices, and child welfare laws. And as a result of being a member on that commission, the commission was able to give the legislature several recommendations for laws that were passed. So I was involved in that, which I was very proud of that effort. Some other things that I have been involved in is I was involved formerly with the former director of the Department of Human Services and my local state senator, Mark Schauer, out of Battle Creek. And we had tried to get them to consider making it mandatory that all agencies would have an alumni or two on their governing boards. And that wasn't able to get through, but we were able to get them to get the Department of Human Services to conduct focus groups with alumni to inform policy and practice. And then I've also done a lot of professional consultation and workshops with groups across the world on how to work more effectively with young people in foster care. So I've been fortunate enough to go all across this great country, done a lot of work in Canada, and have also been in Germany, Italy, and in Australia, working with groups to shape their practices and their policies around working with young people who are in foster care. So those are some of the things that I've done so far.
And what are some of the challenges that still lie in the way of more improvement?
Well, I think right now I'm working with some folks here at Michigan State. I'm collaborating with some folks at Western Michigan to create pathways for young people who are in foster care and who want to go to college and further their education. So we're creating programs at MSU and at Western to help them be more successful, to provide support and counseling and financial aid kind of help, to help them find housing, to help them find mentors, and do different things to help young people transition from being in foster care to going into college. And that's something I'm really excited about and really proud of, because my hope is that the more young people that we can help prepare for college and then eventually graduate from college, the more likely they are, A, to have successful lives, which is the most important thing to me, to raise families, to parent their own children, but hopefully contribute back to the system. So that's something I'm real proud of. And I'm also working on some research right now with my colleague Angelique Day at Michigan State here, where we are interviewing young people and middle-aged people and older people who have been in foster care about their health care status and their access to health care. And we're doing focus groups all across the state. And our hope is that once we can find out what their health care is and their access to health care, that we can inform policy and practice and legislation to provide easier access to health care, which, of course, is a national problem anyhow.
And how much change or success has there been in, say, the last 20 years?
Well, there's been a lot of change. I'm not sure how much success there's been. You know, the theory of change has been is that if we could put certain programs into place, that we could create better pathways for young people who are leaving foster care. So there's been more attention paid to the population. It's become kind of a hot topic. Senator John Chafee, late Senator John Chafee from Rhode Island, had some legislation passed, which is now called the Chafee legislation, which provided resources and tuition grants and money for young people to go to college. The research on that in terms of success is pretty ambiguous. But it's nonetheless a step in the right direction. But I am troubled. I know that a couple years ago I was asked by the Michigan Child Welfare Law Journal to write an article on foster care transition. And as I was thinking about the article, I just by coincidence happened to be talking to a young man who I knew who was at the time 25 or 26 and had actually graduated from college but now was about to become homeless. And as he and I talked, and as I was thinking about this article on transition, it hit me that the challenges that he was facing in the year 2004 were not much different than the challenges I faced in 1974. So when you ask the question about changes and successes, there have been changes. On the other hand, I'm not so sure that the successes have followed the changes. So we're doing some things that are appropriate. I'm not so sure we're doing them with the intensity and the follow-through that we need to.
Well, let's say Governor Granholm or even President Bush came to you and said, John, you're my child welfare czar, and you had a magic wand. Are there two or three key things that need to be done right away, or what are the priorities?
Well, my priorities, that's a great question. My priorities, first of all, would be to get a cadre of alumni that were involved in leadership positions. Just as with the NAACP, we have African Americans that lead that. With the National Organization of Women, we have women that lead that. And by law, the Veterans Administration has to have a veteran leading that agency. So I would make sure we had a cadre of alumni who are involved in that because of the breadth of experience, the sensitivity, and the insight. The second thing I would do is I would dump a lot of resources, invest a lot of resources into capacity building. And I would build a capacity of foster parents. I would build a capacity of young social workers and other people that work with kids that transition out of foster care or that are in foster care, because we simply need to invest more rigorously in that population. And I would also raise salaries, which, of course, in a time of tight resources, it sounds a bit silly. But my belief is that by investing in the front end, we have to invest a lot less in prisons and things like that. The third thing I would do is I would raise the profile of this population through social marketing strategies. It's basically an invisible population. And so in the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, we have appropriately been made aware of the challenges of people of color in America. We've been made aware of the challenges of people with different sexual orientation, of gay people, of lesbians. We've been made aware of the challenges faced by people with disabilities. Of course, we're all familiar with the American with Disabilities Act. So we've been made aware of disenfranchised populations and how we can change societal laws, policies, rules, mores and attitudes about people that formerly may have been considered on the margin. And so I think we've become a much more embracing, a warmer society, probably a more navigatable society. And this population is largely invisible, and I would like to do some social marketing in much the same way that we've done other social marketing to raise the profile of this population, to create better awareness and, I think, better outcomes. It used to be funny 25 years ago, like on the Andy Griffith Show or something, we'd all laugh at Otis the Town Drunk and think that was kind of a funny thing. Now when people are with alcohol problems, we don't think it's cute anymore. The same thing with smoking, for example, another example of social marketing. So I think there are ways around this population that we can create sensitivity and awareness to make their pathways easier and to build their capacity as well.
This may be a bit of an odd question, John, that's come to me, but you're obviously now a successful, well-adjusted member of society and whatnot. Do you look back fondly on any of it, or was there some good that came out of it, or is it just total hell and I'm out of it? You know what I mean? Because most of us look back and I think fondly on some aspects of our life. Is it making sense what I'm getting at?
No, it's a really good question. And what I would say to you is that in many ways, how I look on back on my life probably isn't that much different than how you do or Andy does. I think we all view our lives through a kaleidoscope of things that we enjoyed, things that were positive, things that leave us with warm memories, and I also think that we look back on our lives with some mishaps, some regrets, some things that we wish had happened differently. I doubt there's an adult in America who was raised in a healthy, happy family who doesn't look back and say, "Boy, my dad wasn't so good at this," or "I wish my mom had done these things differently." And so from that dimension, I'm probably not much different. I think what's probably different is the proportion of how I look back on it. And I regret that I do have that I can't change, and frankly, I still feel a bit guilty about it, even though I have nothing to do with it, is we often talk about the impact of abuse and the intergenerational consequences. And I look back at my own childhood and realize that when my mother was abusing and neglecting us, she subsequently, in many ways, abused and neglected her grandchildren, her grandchild, because now my daughter, who's 13, doesn't have a second set of cousins, doesn't have a second set of aunts or uncles, or doesn't have a second set of grandparents. And so when I look back on my own history, I feel sorry for my daughter, who doesn't have that kind of benefit that we hope that kids grow up in this rich Norman Rockwell-like environment. So that's something I look back on with a bit of sadness. And, of course, I wish that I had, you know, parents come to my basketball games and those kind of things. And I wish that I could have, you know, I was in a basketball game. I was an all-state basketball player. And actually had the good fortune in 1973 as a junior to play here at Michigan State in the state semifinals. And we lost the game, but it was an experience I would never forget. And it would have been nice to talk to my dad after the game about how the game went. But, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. But those things do come up.
You mentioned your daughter, and I'm wondering, how does your experience impact how your own role as a father?
That's a good question. It's hard to know. I mean, because I've never had a normal experience. But one thing I am as a parent is I'm very attentive, and I'm very almost overly self-absorbed about my parenting style, because I want to be a good father, and I want to be gentle, and I want to be firm, and I'm very thoughtful about how I do what I do, and I think about those things quite a bit. My wife, who was raised in a typical American family, I think doesn't quite reflect as much as I do, and that's not a criticism, it's a commentary on how being raised in a certain way probably influences what you do. And so I'm a lot more aware of my parenting style, my parenting skills, what I need to improve on, what I think is working well. And I'm probably more intentional than many parents. But I wouldn't trade it for anything. I mean, it's made me who I am today.
Just some closing thoughts, summary, things you want people to remember, bring it all together. What do you want to leave us with?
Well, I think it's important to remember that these people that go through these experiences have a different set of reflections to draw upon, and that there's probably some anger, there's probably some sadness, there's probably some alienation. And while we can't be responsive to each and every person's individual circumstances, simply being aware of the uniqueness of the experiences of this population, I think, is pretty important. Just as those of us that are in the majority in America need to be aware of the differences of people of color or people that are different than us, I think if I could say one thing to the mainstream American population is to start to become more aware of how those experiences shape people's perspectives and their behaviors and their attitudes. A second thing I'd like to leave everybody with is the idea that I really want to push hard, and I know Andy mentioned this in his draft article, I really want to push hard this notion of alumni and leadership roles. I think it's critical, and I hope that we can somehow influence that. Beyond that, I just want to say I appreciate the interest that we have here at Michigan State in this population and what we're trying to do to better their conditions.
That's John Sita, Associate Professor of Social Work at MSU, an alumnus himself of the foster care system who is working to improve the system. There's more on John and his work at johnsita.com, johnseita, one word, johnsita.com, or at socialwork.msu.edu. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today on Impact Radio and Spartan Podcast, and we're on the web at msutoday.com.
The future of radio is 88.9 FM, The Impact.